Poddo.
Welcome to Serve and Volley, the tennis podcast for people who like arguments. I'm Nick.
I'm Pavel.
Hello and welcome back to Serve and Volley. We are here not together in person, we're here remotely. I'm in my living room. Where are you, Pavel?
I'm in my kitchen because there's construction going on, so this is the quietest room in the house.
Wow, are you standing up?
I am standing up.
Okay, well, that really adds an interesting dynamic to proceedings. Hope people are imagining Pavel standing up, possibly still in his pajamas because it's 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, we're midway through the Paris Masters, which is the last opportunity for players to pick up points before the season-ending tour finals. How do you feel like that's going, Pavel?
Yeah, I've caught bits and pieces here and there, and I've enjoyed it. I mean, Paris is obviously, you know, one of the two worst Masters tournaments, along with Monte Carlo, because Monte Carlo suffers from the kind of optional 1000, which is a weird designation, and Paris suffers from being very late in the season where everyone's kind of tired and injured and so on. But I think the players that do show up, like you said, have a lot of them still have something to fight for. For the majority, it's the last tournament of the year. For the others, they hope it will be their penultimate tournament of the year. So you do get some interesting narratives thrown in the mix. At the moment, I'm enjoying Grigor Dimitrov, of course, who came very close to fulfilling my prediction last time of winning Indian Wells. But I'm happy with how he did. And he bageled Karen Chanov yesterday. So really, really in good form. And then I don't know if he's going to get past Zverev, but let's hope so.
That would be nice. It is interesting to have a Masters 1000 tournament in the city that has a Grand Slam. It does always feel like it's going to be a lesser sibling. But there's been a good lineup here, better lineup than we had in Indian Wells. And Djokovic kind of returning kind of anchors that. And he beat Vukcevic. It was a good match. He looks rusty, but got through it, which is the key. And when we compare that, I mean, not that it's a fair comparison, it's a facile one, but compare it to the Murray-Kupfer match, which has been heralded in some quarters in this country as a sort of sign that Murray doesn't have the mentality anymore, losing after having 7 match points. You know, it's interesting to see these players who are no longer winning with the ease that they once did and kind of having to get into really kind of gritty matches. It'll be interesting to see Nadal announce that he'll be back in December with an eye to being ready for the Australian Open. It'll be interesting to see whether any of that kind of invincibility has been chipped away from Nadal. I don't know how you felt about Djokovic's return.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense. It's time. Let's hope for some good matches down the line. I mean, Vukcevic is a good kind of second round opponent, but he's not someone we'd ever expect to beat Djokovic, even on a good day, right? We're here for the, Tsitsipas is out, but we're here for the kind of Zverevs, Medvedevs, and so on, trying to challenge Djokovic and hopefully succeeding. Kind of to the point of the Murray match, I watched the end of it, and I think this narrative is kind of disingenuous and very unfair to Kupfer, because if you look at the, 7 match points, I think something like 5 of them were actually Kupfer winners. So it's not like Murray just kind of froze. Kupfer really obviously had, for him, I'm sure, you know, Murray, he grew up watching Murray and probably one of his heroes. And, you know, he just wanted to bring his absolute best level. Of course, he's a journeyman. He's not, you know, someone that you're like, okay, fair enough, he lost to Kupfer after 7 match points. Like, that's always going to sting. But he did beat Tiafoe in a similar, you know, very protracted, very tense battle last week. And Tiafoe's in pretty good form. He got to the final.
Yeah, and then and then after beating Murray, he's backed that up by beating Félix Auger-Aliassime. So he's having a good week. But you're right. It's always, unfortunately, it felt like Murray had bad draw after bad draw, playing Urquhart 3 times. You know, it's been really hard for him to get any momentum because he's been picked against a relatively high-seeded player in the first round. It felt like this was an opportunity he was going to play. I think he was going to play Brooksby and then Kupfer came in as a lucky loser. So it felt like an opportunity to notch up a kind of good win, and he didn't take it. So it's always going to be a bit disappointing. But in terms of the race to Turin, it's taking shape now. Feels like we probably know what the eight are going to be.
I think it's all pretty much settled, except Cam Nori still has a chance, I think. Well, I'm looking at the race rankings right now. So Hurkacz is on 3,045 points, and Nori has 90 points fewer. So actually, he just has to go pretty much one, maybe two rounds beyond Hurkacz. So it's doable. It's not going to be easy. Hurkacz is playing. Is he playing Kupfer?
Yeah, the draw has really opened up for Hurkacz.
Yeah. He is playing Kupfer. So Nori is going to hope that Kupfer can, you know, keep this magic going. Nori himself is playing Fritz, who's, you know, also in decent form. Yeah, I think there's still something to play for there, but the rest is pretty much settled. We've got Djokovic, Medvedev, Tsitsipas, Zverev, Rublev, Berrettini, and Ruud. And Sinner, unfortunately, with his loss to Alcaraz, has kind of put himself out of contention, unless one of the people ahead of him drops out, which we were talking about yesterday. Tsitsipas withdrawing from his match, Berrettini not playing this week, Rublev having an absolute shocker of, you know, kind of the tail end of a season.
Yeah.
Since reaching the finals with Cincinnati, he's got like a pretty strong negative win-loss record. So we could still see Sinner enter in. I mean, if not, you know, this year, I'm sure we'll see him in the coming years.
We'll discuss that in the second half of this podcast a little bit more. Tsitsipas withdrew from his match against Popperin, and he was 4-2 down in the first set, and he withdrew, and he left. He gave quite a strange statement to the media about how he's not feeling well, it's getting worse, he wants to protect himself ahead of Turin. You know, obviously, it's always disappointing to see anyone withdraw that early into a match, and especially if they felt like they had an injury going in. It seems sort of unfair on when it's such a limited pool for these top-level events. But he's obviously trying to protect himself. He obviously aspires to be in Turin, but he seems, to me, the most likely at the moment to withdraw. I mean, you've got this sort of conspiracy theory that Rublev is actually secretly got two broken legs. He's certainly playing like a man who has one or two broken legs. So, but I don't see any evidence that Rublev is actually injured. He's just playing badly.
Yeah, maybe I'm, you know, kind of giving him a way out of this slump. But, you know, when Thiem was going through this really bad patch and then he, you know, retired with the wrist injury and, you know, missed half a season, Thiem is another one who's coming back very soon. But there might be something mental, there might be something physical, who knows. But it does give hope to the alternate, I think, either way in these situations. If not too much hope, but yeah, Rublev is an interesting case because you would have thought he would be actually kind of a dark horse with Turin, whereas now he seems to be the punching bag in making. Out of these people, four have won the tour finals, right? We've got Djokovic, Zverev, Medvedev, and Tsitsipas, which is quite unusual, I think, going to one of these events. Or is it?
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly it feels like the winners have been so pluralistic in the last 5 years. And you've got two other players who've been playing in the main draw in Paris who've won the World Tour Finals in Murray and Dimitrov. So that must be unusual by historic standards. Then over on the WTA side, I mean, I think the WTA is this is going to make me sound very ignorant if it's not true, but I think the WTA is now pretty much done in terms of, because they don't have another 1,000 tournament. So it looks simply like it's going to be Barty, Sabalenka, Krejcikova, Pliskova, Sakkari, Swiatek, Muguruza, and Badosa.
Isn't Barty out for the rest of the season? Isn't she injured?
Oh yeah, of course. So then that yeah, and Kontaveit is in ninth.
Oh really? Interesting. I've always liked her, but I didn't realize that she was having that good a season.
But it's interesting to see that, like, for instance, Svitolina, who's been consistently ranked in like seeded fourth or fifth at the Grand Slams this year, is ending 13th in the race. Kerber 16th, it's Azarenka 20th. It really speaks to the fact that a lot of the big players on the WTA have not picked up that many points this season, whether it's just a commitment issue, they haven't been able to play as many tournaments. The ATP ranking seems to basically match the race, and maybe not so much on the women's side. I don't know if I can extrapolate a broader point from that, but I was just curious to see how bad Svitolina's season has been. I know she's just separated from her coach of several years, and there's a feeling that they need to reboot.
I know, I saw a stat which is both her and Halep, and I think Thiem as well, like all three of them have dropped out of the top 10, having been consistently in the top 10 for like 5 years. So obviously, you know, the COVID year has been, I guess, a bit destabilizing for some players. Maybe some players feed more off the crowds. Maybe it's a mental thing. Certainly, I think, obviously, Kyrgios, I don't think, was flying high either way. But he had a pretty okay season in 2019. And I think COVID has just basically completely killed his career off. But we're not here to talk about Kyrgios.
We're not here to talk about Kyrgios. But I do think that Australian players who from in Australia, and I guess there are other countries that this probably applies to, do have the disadvantage where, you know, if they want to spend any time at home this year, they have to really prioritize certain events because the quarantine issues are so severe and lockdowns in their home states have been so tough. So it's obviously easier if you're in a country that has had a very agnostic view of the pandemic to cope with the traveling commitments. Yeah, I can see why Kyrgios has had a tough year, but putting aside the issues with his mentality, which I think have not suited struggling through the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's fair, which it makes it even more impressive that the WTA has an Australian number one, right?
She's picked up 6,411 points from this season, you know, which is some 2,000 points off what Djokovic has accrued. So it's just, it's a different level of dominance, I would guess.
Yeah, I think the WTA in general has kind of a flatter points distribution as a rule. But the fact that Barty is number one, both in the race and in the actual rankings, it speaks volumes. She's been consistently the best player for quite a long time now. And that's despite, like, what, age 20, she was like, I might want to be a cricketer instead. And now she's like 25 and the best women's player in the world. So,
well, there's still time for her to become a cricketer.
Osaka is another different case, but yeah, another player that we've expected to see kind of at the top, but we could kind of say that's an injury of sorts, right?
Yeah, I think this season will go down as a sort of asterisk on Osaka's career, and I think you can offer her a sort of mulligan. It's all shaped up nicely. Where is the women's finals this year?
Isn't it always somewhere in Asia?
It certainly used to be, but let's do some live research. It is in Guadalajara.
Yeah, you're right. That's it's a curveball.
Well, we will look forward eagerly to what happens in Turin and Guadalajara in the coming weeks, and we'll do a podcast about them too. So this brings us now to the debate portion of the podcast, and this question I came up with after watching this week Alcaraz, the exciting 18-year-old Spaniard, defeating Jannik Sinner, who recently turned 20, but I will always think of as a teenager. And it kind of brought to my mind the question of who is the most exciting teenager on tour. We also saw, of course, in Romania, we saw Emma Raducanu, who's 18, who's obviously had an incredible year and incredible plaudits, losing pretty comprehensively to 19-year-old Marta Kostyuk. So there's also the question on the women's side. But Pavel, who are you feeling out of all the teenagers? Now, I mistakenly thought that Jannik Sinner was still a teenager, so we will fact check as we go along. But who are you feeling are the exciting teenagers on tour?
Shall we go with the kind of American legal drinking age definition of, you know, who can't get served yet?
Right.
Because that kind of opens up the pool for us slightly more. I think if we just look at teenagers on a men's tour, like Alcaraz, Musetti, that's pretty much it. Like, the next highest ranked teenager is Juan Manuel Cerundolo from Argentina, who's ranked 85. If you could pick him out of a lineup, I'll give you £100. And then after that is Holger Rune, who I have heard of, who's meant to be a very nice and promising Danish prospect. But yeah, and obviously Jack Draper, the Brit, who's ranked like 250. He's about to turn 20. So yeah, I mean, I think teenagers on a men's tour, you know, we're long gone from the days of Boris Becker and Michael Chang. Obviously, Alcaraz looks like a machine. I would hate to play against him. I felt sorry for Murray having to play him like twice in 2 weeks. He's just relentless. Yeah. And you kind of see glimpses of Nadal. Obviously, he's a right-hander, but it's kind of that same intensity and relentless hitting. Maybe, yeah, kind of a blend of Nadal and Ferrer, which is, yeah, don't envy his opponents. I'm sure he's a future top 10 player. Sinner is already a top 10 player, but he's 20. Do we think this is going to be like a men's major final in, let's say, 4 years' time? Or is that getting ahead of ourselves?
You've got to assume it will be, but then I also assume we'll see these some players having these late developments and that sort of thing. And as you say, it's so rare in this age for players to come through as teenagers that you start to think that people will maybe start to actually get into their groove about in their early to mid-20s. So, you know, it's really quite hard to say, but I would be very surprised if neither Sinner nor Alcaraz reached a major final in their career, and therefore, you know, it's just a crapshoot that they'll play each other. But yeah, I'd like to think they would do. Americans are very excited about their young male players. Americans have dominated the last kind of 5 years or so of the women's game, but have started to see these new generation of young male players coming through too. I'm looking at Korda, who's part of this incredible sporting dynasty. Both his sisters are two of the best women's golfers in the world. Brooksby and Nakashima, they're all in the kind of top 10 for the race to Milan. They'll all be there, I think. So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty exciting time for Americans. I think Americans are particularly excited about Brooksby, who seems in recent weeks like he's been able to make that step up and really challenge some good players. But it'll be interesting because America has so long been out of the conversation in the men's game as a kind of major force, having been so dominant for so long, that it'll be kind of interesting to see whether they can push on. I imagine that sponsors around the world are licking their lips about the prospect of some of these players. Obviously, American sporting stars are the most valuable marketing properties, and I think they'd love to see one of these guys start to compete for Grand Slams. I think I could very, very reasonably see one of them, if not more than one of them, making quarterfinals of Grand Slams in the next year. You've got to be thinking that's the next kind of hurdle for them.
Yeah, something about Korda. I mean, he's the most accomplished of those three so far. And obviously his father is a Grand Slam winner, which is pretty good narrative. But yeah, I can't really get into his game. I don't know why. There's something quite clinical about it. I quite like Nakashima and Brooksby. I like the way they kind of hustle around the court. Yeah, I don't know if they're like the most... They don't jump out at me in the kind of Alcaraz way of, oh, these guys are going to be major winners. Whereas with Alcaraz, I mean, it's early days, but I'm pretty certain that he's going to be in contention. But yeah, I think Americans are just so... I mean, who do they have? They have Tiafoe, who I love. You're not a huge fan of, I don't think.
No, I like Tiafoe.
But you don't really like rate his game, right? You just like him as a kind of...
I don't think he's ever going to be a top 10... Well, I don't think he's ever going to be a Grand Slam competitor, let's say.
Yeah, I think you could.
But that's not an insult. I don't intend that as an insult.
Yeah, no, I mean that's fair. Not everyone can do, but yeah. And then you've got Opelka, who's kind of the good version of John Isner, whatever that meme is.
John Isner's benign twin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but again, yeah, very one-dimensional game. Nice guy, but we're long past the Agassi Sampras days. I'm sure American sponsors would love a Brooksby Nakashima Miami final in a few years' time. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's certainly more potential than we've seen from them in a while. And then I guess the one teenager that's quite excited we have mentioned is Musetti, who had a very, very good clay season, just kind of came out of nowhere and broke through. Could see him kind of being in conversation at least for the clay side of things in a few years' time. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's a really good time for Italian tennis. And I think Musetti has that sort of thing of looking like a sort of video game character. He looks like, you know, there's that Pixar made that movie that's set in like the Amalfi Coast or somewhere, and they're all Italian. Luca, he looks like a character from that. he's sort of sweet, where Sinner is sort of slightly demonic, if you were to compare the physical appearance of Italian tennis players, for want of saying anything meaningful about their game. But yeah, no, I think it's, and Sonego it too, in terms of rounding out in a triumvirate of young Italian players, they're all not bad.
Well, Berrettini's obviously.
And Berrettini, of course. And Berrettini, who is not old. Italy's had an incredible year. Sportingly, the greatest year in Italy's history.
Is Eurovision a sport?
Eurovision is defined technically as a sport. So they won Eurovision. They won the Euros. They got the fastest man on earth. And yeah, so in a way, it's sort of a shame that Sinner's not very likely to make Turin, especially as I think that, yeah, he lost a bit of steam in Paris, but I think that he was so good on indoor hard in this fall season, and I think he would be a much more competitive member of that eight than certainly Norrie, and probably Urquhart, who just seems like he's always he's always there. He's always in the last 16 of everything, Urkach. And then if you do that enough, you get enough points. But
yeah, it's interesting. So on the women's side, you were mentioning the Kostyuk Raducanu match, which is, I mean, I remember Kostyuk breaking through at an incredibly young age. You know, she was like 14 or 15 when she won her first match, and everyone was kind of a buzz. This was before Coco Gauff appeared in the scene, so there was a buzz of like Kostyuk being, you know, the next big thing. She hasn't, I mean, she's still very young, and she has just beaten the, you know, US Open champion, so clearly things are going relatively well for her. But yeah, she's ranked 50th at the age of 19, which, you know, for a man, that would be incredibly impressive if we look at the current state of things. For a woman, it seems about par if you want to be an accomplished player later on.
Yeah.
She could still be a top 10 player. She might not, which we'll see.
I think we discussed it in the last episode that there seems to be a different sort of developmental point for women's players. And you saw that with Raducanu Fernández in the US Open final, two teenagers going toe-to-toe. And you've got to remember that people, Grand Slam champions, active Grand Slam champions like Swiatek and Andreescu would still fulfill our criteria of not being able to be served in an American bar. So,
well, Swiatek just turned 20 a few months ago. Yeah, so she's and she's, you know, top five player.
Yeah,
at her peak. Yeah, so that's pretty impressive. Andreescu, I think, is a bit older.
Andreescu is still, is she 20 or 21? But at the start of the year, she's turned 21 this summer. So they're still young by the criteria that we were applying to the men's game, and it's just a different proposition. It's a different question you ask. Who's the most exciting teenager on the WTA? It just remains to be seen what Raducanu can do. I mean, I think coming the fallout from winning the US Open has been a little bit tricky to handle. I think it was probably, with the benefit of hindsight, not the world's most mature decision to get rid of her coach so quickly and not have a new setup in place and end up in this weird position where you're sort of courting coaches, and presumably lots of coaches are trying to proposition her, but she's ended up sort of coaching herself, relying on the LTA to sort of support that rather than just sticking to the end of the season, at least with the coach who had won her the title in the US. And I think that's probably impacted it, but there's also a lot of pressure and expectation. It's not easy to go from winning a Grand Slam to playing your first ever three-set match in, you know, that's always going to be a weird, jarring thing. So I don't know. And then, Swiatek, 20 now, so is not a teenager, but just seems like I think she can still go up a gear, and I think she probably still needs to go up a gear if she wants to challenge Barty to be world number one, or challenge for another Grand Slam title. The way she won the French Open last year was so impressive.
She didn't drop a set, right?
Didn't drop a set, and I think didn't drop more than something like seven games in any match. I mean, it was an incredible thing, and she has done well since then. I think she reached the quarterfinals of at least three Grand Slams this year, so, and she's qualified for Guadalajara. So yeah, I'd like to see her now make a step up to being again a Grand Slam competitor again and challenging Barty for that world number one spot. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the exciting thing about the WTA, right? Is that you always kind of feel like it's more open. You don't have this kind of solidified thing at the top at the men's game where you kind of have the usual suspects always fighting through. Like both Raducanu and Swiatek, like when they won, they looked like by far the best player in the world. And then kind of reality sets in and you realize, you know, maybe Raducanu won't win three majors next year. Very disappointing for all those fans that bet on that. I think we expect players like that to have shown such high promise at such a young age to just kind of keep growing and maturing their game. And I mean, Coco Gauff is not even 18 yet, right? And she's already has some very impressive victories under her belt. So I think that's another one where she hasn't had the kind of incredible peak of Swiatek or Raducanu, but I don't think anyone's going to be surprised to see her win a major, or at the very least be kind of in the semis of a major soon. Both her and Raducanu are obviously very marketable players because Great Britain and America are huge in terms of tennis. And yeah, Raducanu, I think, has... Yeah, the coaching situation is a bit weird, but I think generally she's dealt quite... She seems to have her head on her shoulders and kind of have dealt reasonably well with the fallout. Obviously, you know, her form hasn't been great, but it can be a bit overwhelming being kind of going from the underdog to the favourite. I think you notice that in a lot of these cases, but I'm sure she's going to have a good 2022.
Good. Well, I'm sure she'll take that as a real vote of confidence. And thanks again for listening, Emma. We should end things there before we bore everyone's ear off. And we will be back to discuss Turin, Guadalajara, maybe after, maybe during, because we have made a habit of going in the middle of tournaments, which means that almost everything we say will be out of date within 24 hours. So please keep subscribed and listen immediately to keep up to date with Serve and Volley. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Have a nice day, Pavel.
You too, Dick.